Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwain aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 143.
Having her own Corva is great. She's so useful. Asmodia never wants to give up her shiny new Corva. She'd purchase 3 more if they were available. They actually help with things. What do we do now? File a report with the Most High? Tell Sever as soon as she's not busy wrangling Keltham? Maybe, but I have the feeling that, if we were Keltham, we'd be thinking of something else to do with this theory besides just running off and telling our superiors, "Oh right, I know we make advanced predictions." What else does the Talandrian origin theory of Doth Elan predict, even in probabilities?
So, okay, I remember one of the things that originally got me thinking about this was how Keltham peppers in warnings against ways of thinking that often sound pretty clearly like things you'd observe in Galarian, even though he says he doesn't see the point of them, has never seen the point of them, and can't imagine anyone actually being that silly. Like the thing about certainty. That's not itself an advance prediction, but if someone on his planet has knowledge of ours and is specifically warning against mistakes that we make, even if almost nobody on Keltham's world makes them, I wonder whether we're going to eventually see things that seem even more targeted at ways of thinking that are promoted on Galarian. Doth Elan having fewer plants and animals, but mostly ones we recognize, because it'd be harder to move absolutely everything from our world to a different world, right? And if it wasn't relevant to the project, you probably wouldn't bother. I'm trying to think of probabilities for these, but I'm not sure the math part of my brain is entirely back up and running yet, and I don't really know how you'd assign meaningful probabilities to these sorts of guesses anyway. Exactly. I know you do one probability for each question for the world where Doth Elan has nothing to do with us and really is old, and a different probability for the world in which it's an experimental offshoot. But it's not like I know how many plants and animals a normal HM. No, if it were a totally different planet, I'd expect it to mostly have different animals than ours, I think. And about the same amount. Except that we already know that Doth Elan also has humans, which suggests about the same kind of life.
Don't worry about making up probabilities on likelihoods. Keltham didn't tell the rest of us how to do that either. You might as well say, more or less likely, and leave the law part to me once I know what I'm trying to do with the law. Doth Elan has humans, but no other sapient species. That's lower variety right there. But we could ask Keltham if his world has badgers or archaeopteryxes or bats or giant hamsters or octopi or squirrels or ujahum. I mean, I'd have to think about the context in which to ask him, but that's an obvious thing to check. And see if his world has lots of animal species that Galarians never heard of, but that sound like they wouldn't be all that related to the humans. I think the really big question is whether, if Doth Elan is that close by, a greater scry would let us look at it. Maybe one of the people Keltham's shown us in a silent image, like his writing circle friends or, what was her name, Marin.
Yeah, that's a good thing to check. Now that you say it, I'm surprised we haven't done it already. Although, can you scry people in an anti-magic field? Does it interfere with the sensor? Because I think they must be suppressing their arcane magic somehow, in this scenario, and some ways of doing that might interfere with a scry.
There's also the question of whether, if the creators there are much more powerful than golden dragons, we're willing to risk the scry being traced back to us. Corva. We're not talking about something that's just slightly much more powerful than a golden dragon. Doth Elan isn't a country. We talk about it like it's a country, because their civilization acts like it's one country, but it's a planet, with as many people on it as all of Galarian. Keltham showed you the view after getting into space. The anti-magic field would have to be wrapping their entire planet, maybe their entire star system, because civilizations set up outposts on Doth Elan's moon and on the planet nearby. I mean, their conspiracy could be lying to Keltham about that, I guess, but... Keltham thought that history had been screened off decades ago, not millennia ago. Even if a gold dragon kidnapped 100 people with intelligence 18, which people in Galarian would have noticed, Well, maybe not if it was right in the middle of Aridin's death. But it doesn't sound like Keltham thought his world started out with much fewer people 100 years ago, and then bred really frantically to get 1 billion people. I guess the kidnappers could be duplicating people, like in Keltham's hints about Anthropics. I think the fundamental question is where their knowledge of law could have come from. The Dathi Ilani wouldn't have had time to create it. There, it would have to be stolen from somewhere else.
So, yeah, you're right. The timelines don't add up. Although, hey, that's something this theory predicts, that there is some incident in our past in which a bunch of really smart people disappeared at the same time that neither of us currently knows about. If we do find something about that later, well... But they couldn't have gotten to 1 billion people in 100 years, no. And if they were copying, their population would be way more samey than ours is. I guess we don't know that it isn't. Keltham's hardly been exposed to the full variety of Galarian's humanity. But it still doesn't really work, does it? Even people who are as smart as our smartest wizards with headbands couldn't... Forget about the math. He talked about flying machines. He's surprised by disease. He doesn't know how his people got past our level of metalworking because they already had it. When the screen was put in place, they had to have had time to build all of that. I can think of explanations there, but it's hard to say how contrived they are. Maybe there were 2 phases to the project, one before the screen and 1 after. Maybe it had always been planned that way, or maybe they screened off their origin story because it's about us, and they knew that if anyone ever found a way to unwisely contact us, the whole project could be jeopardized. Maybe there are multiple worlds of stolen people, and... But that doesn't work either. The population still doesn't fit. Forget that. Could they have... Supposing their patron is a god, could that god be the source of their law? If the god had found some way to sequester a population away from the other gods, to hide them? Keltham talks a lot about how the gods have a much better understanding of law than we do, that lawful gods are things that understand the law perfectly. If there's some force interference from the chaotic gods or something, which is why our gods can't just tell us what Keltham is telling us, given that they already know. Would that still have held on a world that had a single godlike protector and no balance of power between opposing factions, Arikan?
So, several major important concepts here. 1. Wrapping an entire planet or solar system in an anti-magic field doesn't sound to me like any one god. That takes something on the scale of Pharasma, or whatever other beings are out there like Pharasma. Rovagug, maybe, had to be on that level. Because otherwise, Pharasma would have easily squashed it. So there's more than one thing like that in reality, and if there's 2, there's more. 2. I don't know what the rules are like, but it can't be as simple as Asmodeus and Abadar and Aurori and Nethys and Caden Kylian setting up a world somewhere and cultivating the kind of knowledge that Keltham knows. They could have done that earlier, if it was possible, if it was allowed. If it's happening just now, it would have to be because of prophecy breaking. And then we're back to there not being time, again, unless they're just pouring knowledge directly out of Axis, and that has to break the rules. Maybe something out of Aslant, another and hidden Aridin, emerging from hiding after prophecy shattered, would know that much. But what makes more sense to me is if they're just from outside, they're just not governed by our rules at all. 3, we still have the question of why Keltham is landing in a romance novel. Why not just throw some Dath Ilani, who knew all that stuff better, straight to Igorian, and let Igorian torture or enchant them to give up all their knowledge? Why a teenage boy who died in a flying item crash and only had a loose idea of how to synthesize one kind of important acid? Why stick him next to Carissa Sevar? Why bounce him to an asexual like he'd find in an AeroLarp? And while we're on the subject, why did Asmodeus tell us not to enchant him? And why did Caden Kylian curse Pilar Pineda with cake powers?
I don't know why Asmodeus told us not to enchant him. I'm not going to try to figure out what Caden Kylian is doing, not right now. I don't think I know enough about him, but I know that he's one of the human gods. He might just think it's funny or something. But I think there are good reasons to pick a teenage boy who isn't one of his people's best and brightest. if there's some reason I haven't thought of why you can't just enchant him and have to trick him instead. Because we couldn't run this operation on their best and brightest, they would see right through us in an hour, and they wouldn't want to work with us. Keltham is smart and well-educated, but he's careless. He doesn't know all the right questions to ask. He lets things hang in the air that probably wouldn't get past an even smarter or more experienced person. I don't know why someone wouldn't have done this before. I agree that there would have to be a reason, and that the timelines don't work for the whole thing being after prophecy. I did think, I don't know whether something could have happened during Earthfall, but that's a really long time ago. It doesn't at all explain why their history would have been sealed off so recently. So, did he say how many decades? It's not right when prophecy broke, is it?
Keltham didn't say. But that's definitely a probabilistic prediction right there. Not a certainty given your theory, but more probable, more likely, if it's true than if it's not. If the timelines matched to within a single year, I'd be certain, not literally probability one, but 50 times surer than I was before, in the posterior. I am so tempted right now to declare that Alter Cheliax would just tell Keltham about this theory so we could ask him about it. But that's a larger decision than I can make, and I don't think I'd be making the decision for the right reasons. I'm just so desperately curious right now. To be clear, this is all well past the point where we'd do literally anything before reporting to Aspexia Rugaton. But we should loop in Savar before we do that and see if the Chosen has her own ideas to include in the report. Or maybe shoots the whole thing down with some objection we didn't see. What's your thought on whether Keltham was placed by something with unbroken prophecy, and whether that required searching through a lot of worlds like Golarion to find one world where events would play out like they did? If that's true, does it mean that some other part of your theory is false or less probable?
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. We mean worlds like Golarion, as in the way that Castrovel is like Golarion, or the way that Shadow Golarion is like Golarion, or just copies of Golarion with different people on them, or...
Whoever placed Keltham had to search through enough different somethings that they could find somewhere where Keltham would land next to Sever, and then bounce over to an asexual, some girl who Nethys would want to oracle, some other girl who Caden Kalian would give cake powers, and also Savar would try to sell her soul and fail, and the government would cover that up from him. It could be millions of slightly different Golarions, which Keltham's transcripts suggested he thought he knew existed. For some reason, I'm not sure anybody followed, but if anyone did, it would be Savar. The part I follow is just that you have to look through a lot of places to find one place like that, if you're not just creating it. Actually, now that I'm really thinking about it, it has to be more like trillions of trillions of trillions, not just millions. Every time you ask for another thing that only happens with 0.1% probability, you have to look through 1,000 times as many worlds, and there've been many things like that. Maybe that's how Keltham knows. Like, he looked up at the night sky once when it wasn't cloudy, deduced how large our whole multiverse was using unknown law, and then knew there weren't enough planets like that for his senders to have found one, unless reality was further expanded in a particular direction.
Okay, I'm sorry, this isn't the important thing, but what exactly is an asexual?
Somebody who doesn't experience sexual desire for men or women, period, no matter who or what you dangle in front of them.
Well, that only multiplies the number of worlds if it's rare then, which I'm not actually sure of.
It's more like one of the obviously special girls, which I sort of admit I am, is an asexual. And then also that special girl is the one who... This part is politically complicated, so pay close attention for your own safety. If you ask Carissa Sevar, she'll tell you that I came back from hell with some sort of superpower that hell told me not to talk about, but Keltham predicted that anyways, which is how she now knows. If you ask me, I'll tell you that I don't have any superpower like that. I'll point out that Keltham also said that the special girl who was asexual would sometimes be the one who didn't have any oracle powers and would just be very good at math. Also, Keltham's prophecy, it's basically prophecy at this point, said that the asexual would be the one who stands back and watches it all. Worlds with asexuals are maybe easy. Keltham's world has them too. It's more that Keltham's sender had to drop him off at the world wound of a planet that would teleport him into a villa near Ostenso, whose wizard academy would have a top graduate slated for the world wound, who was an asexual, and would have the politically complicated quality, and would be the right sort of person to end up running my wall.
Do we have a transcript of the conversation where he said that? I think I want to read it. Because I noticed that one of the reasons that I'm not persuaded that it's rare is that I also don't want to have sex with anyone, ever. And I noticed that I have now been assigned to the wall section. Not that I find that convincing, but it's information you might want to have. So, that's out there, now. Anyway, if I'm going to make a really solid argument about this, I'm probably going to need a written list of every prediction Keltham has made relating to the patterns and likely plot twists of the romance novel that he finds himself in, and which ones have come true and which ones haven't. But my snap judgment is, landing on Sever, that's obviously not chance, but neither is it prophecy. It sounds like personality filtering of the same kind that gods probably do to identify clerics. If Asmodeus grabbed Keltham, it stands to reason that he would drop Keltham on the Asmodean person most compatible with him in the ways necessary for Asmodeus's goals. I'm pretty sure you said the first prediction Keltham made was the question about his harem having interesting backgrounds or problems to solve, but being an oracle isn't that. As far as I've been told, there's no reason to believe that either of the oracles was particularly special until after coming into contact with Keltham. They're not even clerics, which would constrain their alignments a really improbable amount. I tried to look something up about it after I heard about them, and I don't know yet that there are any known constraints on who can become or be made an oracle. So I'm not inclined to give him many points for that either, special as is a corner fortune teller's prediction. It's too vague to give very many points for. Still not very sure that being asexual is rare enough that one of the eight girls was an asexual is particularly surprising either. Or a higher rate than we would normally expect, and I'm not giving him points for it until someone convinces me that it is. The chosen of Asmodeus being unable to sell her soul. I have no explanation for that one. It's legitimately bizarre that he would be able to predict that, but it's one prediction, not many. So I don't think that unbroken prophecy is necessary to explain most of the predictions I've heard, and if it's only one, I'm inclined to think that there's a less bizarre explanation that I haven't thought of yet, especially if he's been making a lot of them. But if he is right, and there are, let's say, trillions of Galarians, then I don't entirely know how that interfaces with my theory. It's a little hard to wrap my head around someone writing a romance novel not by writing it, but by, what, paging through every possible string of words that could make up a book and selecting the one that read most like a romance novel? I guess I'm inclined to say that if more fundamental features of reality do start looking like they would make more sense if they were a romance novel than in any more normal situation, not Keltham's personal interactions, which we and lots of other powers are manipulating constantly, but like, I don't know. The cultural practices of nations, the distributions of traits on our world other than masochism, something that doesn't have as many obvious alternative explanations as masochism. If the world in general starts to look like that, then that should move us towards the romance novel theory, and also away from my theory, because if we're being selected that way, then I don't think there's any reason why we would also expect Keltham's people to have originally been from Galarian. If you can just generate trillions and trillions and trillions of worlds that all independently have humans in them and every possible combination of events. Probably, I guess. Unless Dathilani are all subconsciously into the things that caused their ancestors to have lots of the sex that resulted in their slightly less distant ancestors, and write romance novels that reflect their ancestral environment, even though they have no records of it, which would loop us back around to, I don't even know.
I'll get you the transcripts, though. I suspect that it has a lot more impact when you're living through it yourself. I found my own personal interactions with Keltham and his predictions to be, extremely convincing, especially given the way I had to hide all of Keltham's correct predictions from him. I'd guess it was that way for, like, Sevar, coming back from having faked selling her soul, and hearing Keltham call her out on having faked it. That probably left an impression on her, too. And then there was some whole thing with the Queen of Cheliax that we are not really getting to hear about for what I suspect to be obvious reasons. But, maybe if the Queen shows up, don't say right in front of her that you think the tropes aren't real. It might not be entirely wise. So, now that the topic of special girls has come up, Keltham's romance with me isn't predicated on him ever having sex with me. It's apparently fine for him if we just lie in bed clothed and talk, or sometimes hug. And you possibly hit on an important possibility that was missed by myself, Carissa Sevar, Aspexia Rogaton, and the Queen of Cheliax. Would you possibly, be on track for your own divine empowerment? Though if not, you could also call that a successful prediction of the AeroLARP theory, that Keltham would only end up with one asexual. I'll just ask about your current opinion on Keltham as a boy.
I think he's callous, cruel by the standards of his own society, annoying, careless, thoughtless about the consequences of many of his actions, kind of a shitty cleric of Abadar, kind of a shitty teacher, unnecessarily full of himself, that his judgment of me after one very mild bout of tears was that I am some kind of emotional leper who is going to infect the entire project and take advantage of everyone around me, that he's a sadist who gets off on injuring people badly enough for them to need magical healing, that he's already dating like 8 girls and shouldn't have time for any more, and that in the middle of my crying fit about an hour ago, I fantasized about cutting out his eyes in retribution for having placed me in this position. I'm over that, to be clear. I'm not actually at all tempted to hurt him, but I'm kind of ticked off. I am fully aware that this is a romance novel pattern. I might forgive him. I might get to the point of enjoying working with him, but if you see me change my assessment of him to the point of wanting to have a serious romantic relationship with him, or, gods forbid, falling in love with him, and I'm not doing it because someone has a metaphorical knife to my throat, throw out all of my arguments and consider it a major piece of evidence that we're in a romance novel, or that someone is mind-controlling me to make you think that. But I'm very confident that it won't have happened naturally.
People who seem to passionately hate you at first, and then fall in love with you, are also a frequent plot development in state-approved, chellish romance novels, of the sort that are safe lunchtime discussion topics in Ostenso Wizard Academy when Paxti and Ioni start going on about them. So I know that having an enemy who hates you, and then they fall in love with you, and then you get to wreck them, is a romance novel pattern. But now that I think about it, do you think it'd be a Dath Illani romance novel pattern? Though maybe we're in the kind of romance pattern that their keepers get to read about, and Keltham only got to read the censored kind. How about if Keltham doesn't know that you hate him for a while? I mean, that might be a good idea even for other reasons, but definitely it's a good idea because we're still hiding the tropes from him. Asmodia is feeling sort of queasy for some reason. The problem is, Sevar's going to think that would be incredibly important for her corruption plan, if there's some way to get Keltham to be into it. She'll offer you anything you want, to go along with it, if it gets that far. You could ask for your sister back, and Sevar would make it happen in a heartbeat, but Sevar's not actually going to take no for an answer, I don't think. At least nobody's going to try to nudge Keltham into that, until after he's been raping Pilar for a while. I think you're safe until then, at least. It's not a certain thing the corruption plan ever gets that far at all. You might not even be one of the destined girls, period. I'm sorry.
Well, if she's not going to take no for an answer, then I guess it doesn't matter whether I'd trade it for anything. I do think that particularly hating your love interest is a more general, it's not just a chelish thing, I don't think. I think there's something with, it's a way of introducing conflict to a story that otherwise wouldn't have it. But Dath Illani writers might be better at coming up with conflicts and not need a crutch like that.
Sevar is a lot more concerned with the project succeeding than with us being good Asmodeans. If she thinks she can get a 10% better chance of success by having you on her side, and not just forcing you into things, she'll go full heretic on whatever it takes to get you on her side. I do think we probably have at least a month before it becomes a possible issue, even at the rate Keltham is going. Having a love interest who hates you, and them not falling in love with you, and you getting control of them anyways, is also a romance novel trope. Anyways, I think we're at the point where we actually do loop our superiors in on things, if Seaver is free.
Keltham is now working up the project's non-disclosure agreement with the professional alchemist who was brought in.
Callous, cruel by the standards of his own society, annoying, careless, thoughtless about the consequences of many of his actions, kind of a shitty cleric of Abadar, kind of a shitty teacher, unnecessarily full of himself, that his judgment of me after one very mild bout of tears was that I am some kind of emotional leper who is going to infect the entire project and take advantage of everyone around me, she reads aloud off the transcript. The point I do want to make, Talandria, is that at least half of those traits in my assessment are not innate, but are purchased through really quite a lot of effort. Actually, based on some of the things he said this morning, my current theory is that our lives are being made significantly easier by some ways, Dath. Elan weakened him for us in advance. The warning about emotional lepers thing felt like that. What kind of lawful good society thinks that way? If I imagine the question being put to a paladin, I'm supporting my ill friend, but it's stretching me beyond my means, I imagine them saying, and maybe we should have someone run out and check this right now. Good for you, but remember that if you take ill yourself, you help no one, so pay yourself enough attention to stay healthy.
Korva isn't really clear on whether she's supposed to say anything to that or just listen to the lecture, so she's going to opt for just listening to the lecture until that's cleared up. Asmodia didn't ask whether she thought the Chosen was doing a good job. Obviously she is. She asked what Korva's opinion of Keltham was in the context of wanting to date him.
So what's Dath Elan doing? A wild guess that recently occurred to me is, I think it is the conceptualization of Golarion good people that good is effortful, that it is not intrinsic to human nature, and that we ought to fight our intrinsic selfish nature in order to do the right thing. Dath Elan instead seems to have tried to breed people for, what would you even breed for, if you were breeding for good?
If they're from outside the reach of Pharasma, they may simply not have our concept of good as something to target. Keltham didn't have a concept that meant evil as in the alignment, for the word to translate into, and that's why this whole conspiracy wasn't blown in the first hour. They're not breeding for good, they're breeding for something else they, or the keepers, or the real master of the experiment, decided to target. I don't think we know very much from the transcripts. Intelligence? Probably also wisdom. And they thought Keltham was too selfish. Yes, servitor race?
Doesn't quite fit. They seem to have had the impulse to service trained out of them as well, and not just sexual service. But I think at minimum they selected on a kind of interpersonal squeamishness, a deep dislike of harming the person right in front of you. Built the kinds of people who'd have a hard time in war because they'd think about how all the enemies have wives who'll weep for them, who find it painful and stressful to fire people, who are manipulable by people being sad at them. And then they noticed what a horrific weakness that is and tried to counter it by telling everyone very forcefully that they must tone down their natural impulse towards sympathy for sad people and show them only indifference. That it takes expertise to ease human suffering, and non-experts shouldn't even try. Talandria, you're supposed to talk when I speculate on these things. Three people's random guessing will be worth more than one.
So, well, compassion for suffering right in front of them, right? You could probably measure and select people for that, and maybe like if the entire world were made of people from Last Wall, except smarter. And also they had solved all of their problems, but they still had the discipline left over from when they did have problems, and they were still all kind of organized in many of the same ways. Except that really doesn't mesh with how Keltham is at all. He doesn't act like someone from a planet that was just sort of residually full of military norms.
He really doesn't. Until he reacted so strongly to you crying, I actually hadn't considered the angle that they'd be running into problems from excessive goodness, even though of course they would. But it does seem that they pointed a lot of indoctrination at, some people are problems and you mustn't try to help them. That callousness is a virtue both from the perspective of good and from the perspective of evil.
Personally, I'm trying to throw out everything I know about good and evil and start over to envision a society that sees the entire world using a different alignment chart created by some being who wasn't Pharasma and maybe doesn't use 9 sorting categories at all. It's actually quite hard and makes me feel like I might understand Keltham a little better. Our world's structure must be absolutely strange to him. Even when he tries to throw out one of his basic assumptions, he just makes a different wrong assumption instead.
And we sure would be having some problems if it wasn't. I do want someone to send to a good priest somewhere and present them the question about the sick friend.
Taldorians in the facility, too. Do we have any atheists who haven't been executed yet, to ask? Doth Ilan doesn't have gods. Whatever built the place, it didn't want worshippers.
I think atheists here are fundamentally different in character from atheists in places where there aren't any noticeable gods.
Is it possible that the people who have problems as significant or more significant than ever having cried are also all unbearably Keltham's sideways conception of good, and all kill or remove themselves, which would ding them, but avoid dinging anyone else? And then the rest of the population isn't actually any better at handling interpersonal problems in a way that wouldn't make them evil. Then people on Galarian, they just don't run into those problems at all because all of the weak people are dead. And then they're not good in the sense of having any resistance to evil, just in the sense that they've somehow cut out everything that normally makes it convenient.
They've got to turn up the occasional person who doesn't care at all about hurting other people in a population of 1 billion. But maybe they don't turn up any. Dilemmas for good, yeah. Any people who are weak and useless and who good says you're supposed to be compassionate to anyway?
Yeah, especially if people usually weed themselves out well before the point where they would actually be causing what we would consider significant inconvenience for other people.
From the perspective of the super powerful being running the place, it wouldn't want any experimental failures hanging around clogging the place up, using resources, or reproducing. The story the population was given about what they're doing may tell us something about their natural temperaments. What they're doing doesn't tell us as much. I also note that the place may be non-Pharasman enough that the whole thing with people going into the cold to wake up later isn't suicide. Or if it's suicide, isn't that being's equivalent of evil? Or if it's evil, doesn't send you to a particular afterlife based on that?
I wouldn't expect it to get counted against them as suicide. They think of it as more like petrification, to be unpetrified by a civilization that has the resources to deal with you. Even if they're wrong and the bodies are all destroyed, that's how they're imagining it.
That's fair. I don't think we really have any evidence on their afterlife situation. They wouldn't have any way of seeing whether they were going anywhere without magic. But we have all of the weak people petrify themselves is also not something that rings like what a Galarian nation that was aiming for good would come up with, even if Pharasma doesn't specifically disapprove of that specific step, which I guess we've already established that, yeah, they're not aiming for a Galarian understanding of good.
By far, the most important information we need out of all this is what it says about that super being's concept of romance novels.
I don't know. I think it's also very relevant to my project of corrupting him. If we knew the thing he was scared of, here, we could have Korva pretend to be it and validate his impression that all compassion is a grievous weakness or whatever exactly his impression is. I don't want to risk that at my current level of confusion. As far as the romance trope goes, if Doth Ilan has something about winning over people who hate you, I'd much sooner point him at Lady Avaricia, who I expect can play the part a little more cleanly and who is also doing the openly disliking Keltham thing.
Asmodia bets that doesn't work unless Avaricia hates him personally the right way and requires that Avaricia even be a special girl at all. But Asmodia's not pointing that out to Savar if it keeps Korva out of trouble for longer. Maybe there's a way to corrupting Keltham through law? Or by learning his law? That feels like It should be part of the romance novel. And what I'm thinking in particular is, we tell Keltham, and we're not in fact lying to him, that one of the Project Lawful girls came up with an interesting theory about Dathylon, though she wants to stay anonymous for now. We copy to Keltham her advance predictions based on Talandrian origin theory, like about the distribution of animals in his world. And if we can zero in to where she's getting those predictions right, we can at some critical point reveal to Keltham her theory. That his world was created by a super being, that the keepers were placed in control all along, and that Dathylon's real masters didn't like his selfishness because that made him less useful to something else's experiment. You'd have to time it right, but as a step in his corruption, it feels like that could be Korva's role in the romance novel, which doesn't require Keltham to hurt Korva and makes her be valuable as something other than a torture doll.
I'm not firmly opposed, but it sure doesn't happen in Alter Cheliak's Asmodia.
Does it not? What does Alter Cheliax do when Alter Talandria tells me about her theory? I'm worried about what it does to Keltham, if she's right. I probably write a report to the Most High, because that's how info-hazard protocols work in Alter Cheliax. Alter Talandria is nervous about coming to Keltham's attention after their last interaction. I still know how beings who aren't lawful need to make their predictions in advance. We don't want to add it to Keltham's plate while he has so much else on his mind, either. Even if we're right, it's something that can wait.
It kind of feels like in Alter Cheliax, Asmodia is somewhat less fiercely attached to Talandria, but she doesn't know where she got that intuition, and maybe it's wrong.
PL timestamp, day 25, 21, early afternoon.
Time to rate tests. He called Carissa back in for this part, for second and independent opinions. Willa Shalira just kept talking about probabilities everywhere, and it was hard for Keltham to make out what was prior, likelihood, or posterior. There's a reason why well-designed languages have three different words for those. And Willa is expressing things in strange, awkward ways, mathematically speaking. But she could be saying the correct things awkwardly, and therefore probably is. Alexandre Escara seems to have a solid grasp of the basic way to apply math in principle, but to have not quite grasped what mortals can't do at all, let alone without computers. Still, that's better than a lot of other exam submissions. If you look at it as, tried to invent a new way of expressing his ideas about probability, and didn't completely screw that up, it becomes some evidence of Galarian genius. Dathylon Avaragonus. Lady Avaritia has apparently caught up to Meritzel in her grasp of law, as to be expected of a... But Avaritia was a trivial proof for Tier 1 regardless. Nobody matched the standard set by Carissa or Asmodia, but that's only to be expected. Korva would have made it in easily as Tier 2, based on what she wrote down before she cracked. She did have any idea of what the law meant at all, and that, combined with her chemistry work, would have been more than sufficient. Keltham feels awful about that, like he made some basic mistake, like there was supposed to be some better outcome than this. But, well, that's what everybody warns you. Happens any time you deal with mental health events, in any capacity other than, I am an actual trained professional doing what I have been trained to do. The cleric of Asmodeus, whose report claimed him to be excellent at mathematics, may in fact be excellent for Galarian at math, but doesn't seem able to relate his proofs to the structures of lawful thought. He proved the rule of succession rigorously using integral calculus instead of the discrete calculus that Keltham used, which is hella impressive for somebody who'd never heard of the gamma function up until that point. But then, couldn't answer any of Keltham's actual questions about how to use the rule of succession inside of science. He's not made any progress on prestidigitation chemistry. Fail him out, Tier 2, in case they run into a purer math problem at some point. This person seems maybe useful if they run into just the right kind of problem, but Keltham can't guarantee that, and it's famously bad for mental health to hire people and then not have enough work for them. Carissa, thoughts?
Failing him out seems fine. It seems like he treats every question as practically in isolation anyway. So if we later present him with a pure math problem, I doubt he'll be impaired by not having followed along with the lecture up to that point.
Assumes he's otherwise willing to stay around the fortress, and if we're asking him to do that, I think we pay some option value fee to him. But if he's willing, then sure. Any other opinions Carissa has about hires, non-hires, and tiers?
She's inclined to err on the side of leaving more people in. Some of them might catch up later or think of something from an original angle, so long as they seem to be basically following along and understand the fundamentals of what is being covered. She's not seeing any new Tier 1S here aside from Avaricia.
He would have guessed Willa Shalira for Tier 1, based on her combined math and chemistry performance. But even in Dathilan, it's easier to promote people later than demote them. And he'd guess that effect to be exacerbated in Cheliax, where there's no explicit emotional disciplines against loss. Gain asymmetry. Offer Willa Tier 2 at first, but be ready to jump to Tier 1 if she counter-negotiates. It shouldn't make a lawful difference to where she ends up, but could make an emotional difference to her trajectory, whether she's Tier 2 on watch for promotion or Tier 1 on watch for demotion.
Yeah, sure, that works.
They'll finish agreeing on job offers while the doom-tested candidates are still well inside their promised two-hour break time. The decisions didn't end up very ambiguous, in the end. Keltham will, trying not to sound diffident about it because new gender tropes, note that he's been feeling slightly more distant from Carissa over the last week or so. If he already knew an order he could give her to solve this problem, or could drag her off to his cuddle room and hurt her to fix the problem, he would have already done that. This problem is not being produced by Keltham's hesitation to do something he already knows he wants to do.
Huh. Carissa has also noticed this, but on her end, it's straightforwardly that many evenings Keltham is sleeping with other people, which she assumes he wants to do and intends to continue doing. Possibly it'd be good for there to be something going on between the two of them which does not have the property shared by both kinky sex and serious conversations about bad things in the world, where Keltham wants to do them incrementally and not rush to the end state, and which are therefore things to be rationed rather than indulged on impulse whenever one feels like it. She's not sure what a good candidate thing would be. There's the problem where many topics of conversation turn into the serious conversations about bad things in the world, failure state. She has been working on training into wondrous items to decompress in the evenings, but that's not a good shared activity. She could watch his magic practice and give extremely spellcraft-loaded advice, but isn't sure he'd find that fun. It's also possible that how much he's in the mood to give orders varies for him week to week. She thinks that's true of some people and can mess up a relationship founded on giving orders. Some people vary all the way to in the mood to take orders now, but Carissa suspects she'd have noticed if Keltham were like that. But if he has even the weaker version, then querying, what do I want to do with Carissa, might come up empty.
During his first couple of weeks here, they were fighting large problems together and making progress on them together. Now it's more, split up, Keltham working on chemistry, things in the project feeling more routine. They're both still working, but they're not fighting together the same way. Carissa being tied to a bed doesn't always give her the same chance to impress him, maybe. Impress is not exactly the right word, but of the things Carissa's described, her watching his magic practice and giving him extremely spellcraft-loaded advice sounds closest to being right to him. It's something they can work on together, succeed on together, and someplace where she can remind his brain that she's Carissa Sevar. It's maybe something for him, like his being dangerous is, for her, that she's got ludicrous spellcraft. Not just that she's a valuable possession, but that she's somebody who could have had the Queen of Cheliax if Keltham hadn't gotten to her first.
Well, I'd be happy to watch your magic practice and give you advice. Once you get good enough at magic, you'll be able to be impressed by the things I can do, which is something I'll look forward to.
Then let's try it. How is Keltham at spellcraft by Carissa Sevar's standards? He's been a wizard for like 2 whole weeks now, and is smart, and already knew some math.
He's appalling, but she's used to that. For some reason, the wizard academies barely teach this, and so everyone's appalling. Usually less appalling, but still. She will avoid being rude about it and will instead just give pointers ordered by importance to address.
Just to be, like, super clear here, because Golarion, if Keltham went and got Lady Avaricia for a second opinion, would Lady Avaricia be pointing out more things that Keltham was doing wrong and being less encouraging about his overall state of competence?
I would be very surprised if she noticed any errors I didn't notice. Her spellcraft's nothing impressive herself. Well, she's third circle at 18, which is actually very impressive, but for a third circle wizard, her spellcraft is actually notably mediocre.
It's more that I wanted to explicitly verify you were telling me about what all you noticed. I mean, not all you noticed, but not soft-touching my overall performance level. Keltham will hang 4 cantrips under her supervision, 1 silent image, and then if her supervision helps for that sort of thing, do some scroll practice.
She isn't failing to mention things that might be useful to spare his feelings. That seems like it'd make it kind of pointless to have it be her doing it. She will have lots of opinions. Fundamentally, spellcraft is about anticipating the ways that magic hung in any particular state is obviously going to behave, so that you can move it to desired states without it thinning out, swinging wildly, sticking to other parts of itself, curling up, etc. Once you understand exactly how the magic is going to behave, the way you understand how your own fingers are going to behave, the way you can reach out for something without calculating exactly how far your hands have to travel to get there, then you're going to be able to cast more or less any spell you've seen the structure for. Obviously, there are lots of explicit heuristics that can be taught, and a good understanding of tension and flows and the way attraction that falls away with the square of distance makes things behave, but you also have to get an intuition for it. It'd be really nice if he could cast Arcane Sight and see what she sees, but she can't think of any way to do it. Maybe he could sell a devil a millionth of his soul for Arcane Sight.
Joke rather than serious suggestion, right? Because how would that work? Sell them my soul with 1/1,000,000th probability.
You know, I had in mind a joke, but now that you say that, I don't know that that isn't allowed.
I'd want to be pretty sure of the random number generator. Write into the contract that it doesn't work if the random generator proves to be fixed, and have an option to buy back the contract at some reasonable markup, like 50 times the price of Arcane Sight. Keltham is not insensible of how much this would basically be a weird loan, allowing him to capture an unreasonable amount of value himself. But if Hell will basically sell me Arcane Sight now, in exchange for probably a large payment later when I buy back the contract, it seems like plausibly a nice cheat that cheating people should cheat about.
I do not know if Hell will do that, but I do love cheating at things in order to get more magic. We could at least write Lurilatha and ask if it's worth trying.
I'll route to Subirax first. We don't need to bother Lurilatha unless Subirax doesn't know already. So is Carissa Seaver any good at, like, teaching spellcraft to Keltham?
Moderately? She's clearly noticing a bunch of things that aren't even worth particularly trying to pick up at his level, but she has a much deeper model of what goes wrong every time anything goes wrong, and can show him with an illusion. See, when you did this, that bit was dragging in a way that'd be a real problem if you'd been subsequently trying to close that loop. She clearly hasn't done a lot of teaching before, but she has done a lot of paying attention to Keltham and thinking about how to explain things to Keltham before, and it's sort of the same skill.
Well, but are there concrete results in terms of skill acquisition? Can he now, like, hang 2 first circle spells in the same day, or cast one of the more difficult practice scrolls without failure?
Yep, with her assisting, he can get harder practice scrolls down.
At the current rate of progress, how long until he can cast third circle wizard scrolls like Major Image?
She hadn't been aware that was a specific aim of his. If they're willing to burn through a bunch of failed scrolls trying, he could probably land it tomorrow. They might burn 10 along the way, but he's rich, right?
He'd be able to show them proper high-resolution video of Dathilan with actual sounds. What's the cost of a Major Image scroll like?
375 gold pieces.
What the superheated toilet paper? Why, since when do 10 casts of Major Image cost roughly the same amount as an intelligence headband?
Paying a wizard to cast it for you 10 times would, of course, be much, much cheaper. The expense is that scrolls use spell silver or magical inks with similar properties to hold the magic for you so you don't have to be competent to hang it, and they require quite a lot of the reagent they use.
This is frankly insane, and yes, Keltham should have checked that before spending a lot of time on scroll practice. though it's probably good spellcraft practice in general, since it lets him keep going past his daily wizard magical capacity. Is there a loanable magic item Keltham can rent, which would let him cast a few major images? For that matter, what was the rent price of goggles of detect magic, or of arcane sight, now that Keltham has any money?
Probably rentable for a day for a couple hundred GP. Though there are few enough such goggles that it'd be a matter of going and asking individual wizards who have them. In Cheliax, most wizards get arcane sight off hell instead, so the goggles are even less common. Magic items that let you cast spells with a duration concentration are generally not possible to make.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to Executive Producer John Doe 7776059.